distracted by his cell phone. For the almost quarter mile of clear vision of Hillary and Willie he would have had if he were paying attention while he was driving, he saw nothing. Eric missed hitting Hillary, who was skiing behind Willie, by only a few inches. Startled, she looked up and watched in horror as Eric's speeding car struck Willie from behind. "My beautiful son was killed instantly." Chapter 30. The Other Side of Time. Remind me each morning of your constant love, for I put my trust in you. My prayers go up to you. Show me the way I should go. Psalm 143, verse 8, Good News Translation. By midnight on the 21st of June, thanks to God's grace and the efforts and graciousness of a local acquaintance and philanthropist, Bill, Peter, myself, our family's minister, and our dear friends Dave and Ellen, who just happened to be at a point in their careers where they were able to suddenly drop everything and leave town, were being propelled through the blackness of the night sky on a private flight to Maine. Our daughter Betsy, who had been visiting friends in Vermont, was being driven by them to Fort Fairfield, and Elliot was staying with Hillary's family. After a night of disbelief, they, along with Elliot, met us at the airport when we arrived early the next morning. Willie died instantly, so he was never taken to a hospital. We drove directly to the funeral home and spent the long hours of the morning cleaning the blood from Willie's broken body and anointing him with our tears and with our love. Through this time of unimaginable sorrow, God gently held us, loved us, and carried us. We visited the site of Willie's death, and I was struck by many emotions as we slowly examined and absorbed the details of the area. My first observation was that Willie was not there. I felt no deep connection or emotional reaction to the physical place. It merely felt like the place where his spirit had left this world. Secondly, I had the sense that he had tried to make it as nice a spot for us as was possible, accessible, identifiable, and beautiful. His crumpled body had landed in an area blanketed by blossoming wild alpine roses, overlooking a valley with a meandering stream and rolling green hills. I'm not sure why it matters to me, but the sight of Willie's death was as notable a sight as one could wish for. God took our son, but there was no grim reaper. I believe he sent his most gentle and loving angels to collect Willie's soul and take him to heaven. Our days in Fort Fairfield moved quite slowly, with a decidedly altered sense of reality. Our faith, our minister, and our friends gave us the support and firm but compassionate guidance that allowed us to stagger through these days. Without them, and the unqualified acceptance that our lives are all part of God's larger plan, it would have been nearly impossible to endure the trip to Maine or the very emotionally draining journey home with Willie's ashes. While in Maine, we had been protected and sheltered from people and telephones. As we traveled home, we became increasingly anxious about what the next days and weeks might bring. We had no desire to talk to anyone or see anyone. We really just wanted to stay in our isolated and insulated world of pain. It was, therefore, deeply emotional for us to be immediately pulled out of that world and into the thoughtful and compassionate support of our friends and neighbors the moment we arrived at our home. They had lined our front porch with a loving collection of flowering plants. Willie deeply appreciated the beauty of blossoming flowers, but he was never a big fan of cut flowers, as they serve such a transient role. Cut, appreciated for a limited time, then being thrown out with the garbage. Our neighbor's decision to bring flowering plants in pots rather than cut flowers perfectly honored Willie and visually embraced us with their love. Along with the flowers came the promise of planting them the next week in what would become a perennial flower garden. My only job was to decide where the flowers should be planted. Our home sits on 6 acres of previous ranch land. Other than wild grasses, The only vegetation consists of the trees, shrubs, and patches of domestic grass that we planted when we built and landscaped our house. It is not extensively landscaped, but I have always found great pleasure in walking around the property and studying the land. Willie and I often shared this pleasure together, and we enjoyed noting the many changes in color, shape, and fullness of the various plantings as the earth moved through its seasons. In the days after our return from Maine, walking our property was the one activity that brought a small semblance of calm to my turbulent and broken spirit. As I walked, I tried to make sense of my life, contemplated what to say at my son's memorial service, and made detailed mental accountings of our property, trying to decide on a site for Willie's flowering garden. One morning, as I was walking past a small grouping of willow trees, I came upon a great surprise. The area around and within every willow was overflowing with the vivid, bold, deep pink-colored blossoms of wild alpine roses. These flowers were of the exact color, shape, and appearance as had been the ones blooming in the field in which Willie died. Prior to visiting Willie's accident site, I had never seen one of these blossoms, and I most definitely had never seen one on our property. Willie knew the story of the pink blossoms on the Bradford pear tree that had appeared immediately after the death of my stepfather. He knew how significant and emotional that event had been for my mother and me, and he would have seen the painting of the tree hanging in my bathroom many, many times. I know that Willie sent us a message that day through the roses, one of appreciation, love, gratitude, and a sense of apology for leaving. I believe he knew this would be one of the few ways of communication we would not question. Completing the story of the Bradford pear tree, after beautifully blooming for 5 years, it was suddenly and unexpectedly struck by lightning and destroyed, serving as a message telling my mother that it was time to move forward in her life. It makes me wonder if the beautiful alpine roses that we now so lovingly nurture on our property will one day disappear. Chapter 31. Gifts of Compassion. When I look into your eyes, I know there is a God. Human compassion and the capacity to love are not the result of mere chance. Charles W. Gertz III. In the initial weeks following Willie's death, there were other gestures of love and gentleness that my family and I found comforting. One day, a notebook appeared on the bookshelf. In it were several letters that Willie had written on the eve of his 19th birthday, which was several months before his death. He had written letters to some of his coaches and close friends, thanking them for the memories, their long-standing friendship and support, and for the impact they had on his life. His letters were from the heart, and almost seemed like a goodbye letter. Unusual for an 18-year-old. He also wrote letters, one to President-elect Obama and to Will.i.am, a musician he admired, and one to President Lincoln, in which he noted the sense of calm and deep inspiration that he felt when sitting in Lincoln's monument in Washington, D.C. Willie wrote that he felt like he could make a difference and that he could become the next Abraham Lincoln. He wanted to make the whole world a better place. Willie also wrote a letter to himself. In it, he talked about the great adventure his life had been. He observed that his life lacked simplicity, but guessed that was because there was so much to see and do in such a short time. He also wrote about how grateful he was for his family, his friends, his God, and for his faith. This letter was such a gift to me. It reassured me that Willie had a relationship with God, understood its importance, and was right with God before his death. Willie had a way of making everyone feel special and feel that they each had a special relationship with him. After Willie's death, many people came forward to express their sadness and to express their gratitude for the life Willie led. They all mentioned ways he changed their lives for the better. Senator John Kerry called to express his condolences. He noted Willie's influence in his office, the changes that Willie inspired, and the impact he had on the senator's staff. Senator Kerry also taped a video tribute for Willie's memorial service. Singer-songwriter Carole King, who was also inspired by Willie's passion, sent us the following lyrics and music, which we played at his memorial service. Her song has given us a great deal of comfort, as the music is beautiful and the lyrics apt. In the name of love. Do the things you believe in the name of love, and know that you aren't alone. We all have doubts and fears. Know throughout every season, you are the name of love, and you'll keep on feeling at home throughout the coming years. Change is for certain, this we all know, each day opening the curtain on a brand new show. Through your sorrow and grieving, don't forget the name of love. It goes on without any end, forever. Birth and life and death make a circle we are all part of. To see the light everlasting, live in the name of love, forever. Community members wept and grieved with us. The skiing world was shocked and heartbroken. Hundreds of people from across the country came to Willie's memorial service, prayed with us and for us, and did what they could to lessen the pain. We met with our minister daily and were surrounded by close friends. I taped the following daily creed to our refrigerator and grasped onto it for survival. My daily creed. I believe God's promises are true. I believe heaven is real. I believe nothing can separate me from God's love. I believe God has work for me to do. I believe God will see me through and carry me when I cannot walk. God continued to carry our family month after month as we struggled to put one foot in front of the other. I do not understand how anyone can make this journey without trusting in God's plan. Growing up, I was taught that Psalm 23, verse 4, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me," referred to one's own death and the dangerous journey back to God. Now I believe it actually refers to the people who are left behind to grieve. As grieving people walk through the valley of the shadow of a loved one's death, their sadness, confusion, anger, and despair can inadvertently prop open the door of their hearts, allowing evil to silently enter. I had experienced death before, of grandparents, of parents, of friends, and I have found that grief is always a lonely, isolated process, as the death of a loved one carries different meaning to each person who is grieving. In those circumstances, however, it is usually possible to look to a spouse or other family member for support. The isolation of grief after the death of a child or a sibling is exponentially magnified by the fact that close family members, who might otherwise be able to offer support, are equally wrought with grief. God's timing is always perfect, and I think this may be why I was unmotivated to put my story into words before the spring of 2009. The writing of this manuscript was an emotionally intense experience for me. I had been very rigorous over the years with regard to restricting the amount of time I allowed myself to think about the events surrounding my own death and return to life. I love my life. I love my family dearly, and I know that my work on earth is not done. Despite that, recalling the alluring magnificence of God's world too vividly would make it easy to be consumed by a deep longing to return. I have always guarded my heart by not thinking about it too vividly or for too long. I imagine that this desire is similar to the deep longing recovering addicts must feel when they fondly recall the best times of their previous substance abuse. Anyway, I always found it emotionally draining and dangerous to spend too much time remembering not just the facts and events, but re-experiencing the actual emotions. In writing this book, I allowed myself to fully embrace the spiritual experiences I had during my accident and its aftermath, reliving the details and immersing myself in the physical, emotional, and spiritual reality of that time. In doing so, I was freshly filled with the remembrance and acknowledgement of God's continuing and active presence in my life, His absolute grace, His pure love, and His promises for the future. I was again filled with the joy of His Spirit and the knowledge that every event is a part of a larger and more beautiful tapestry. Revisiting and re-experiencing these emotions and memories gave me the ability to be the physical, emotional, and spiritual rock of support that proved to be so essential for my family and my community after Willie's death. Perhaps if I had written this book several years earlier, I would not have so clearly remembered the words spoken to me by the angels or the many reasons for returning me to Earth. Bill and I were surprised to find that a predominant emotion during the first year was fear. Fear that we would never emerge from the emotional fog. Fear that we would never again be able to experience joy. Fear that we would fail our remaining children. Fear that we would forget. I think much of the fear and anxiety we felt was just fear of an unknown future that would not include the son that we loved so dearly. Someone told me, "When you love with all that you have, you grieve with all that you are." And I would certainly agree with this observation. I did believe that God, if asked, would not only carry us, but also would protect our souls during this emotionally vulnerable time. Regardless, it was difficult for my husband to eradicate his feeling not just of sadness and fear, but of despair. Chapter 32. Perfect Timing. There is some good in the worst of us, and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we are less prone to hate our enemies. Martin Luther King, Jr. I am an avid skier, and 8 months after Willie's death, my son Elliot and I were skiing in the backcountry. This form of skiing involves placing synthetic animal skins on the bottom of one's skis, making it possible to climb up snowy mountainous terrain that is otherwise inaccessible. Upon reaching the summit, the skins are removed from the skis, and the thrill of then skiing downhill, usually in fresh powdery snow, makes all of the uphill effort worthwhile. I love to amuse my kids, so at the end of the afternoon I was showing off for Elliot, who was videotaping my skiing. I decided to ski over a gully and try to catch air. Not something I do well, but always something that makes Elliot and my other kids laugh. Rather than catching air, however, my skis twisted in different directions and I broke my ankle. At least Elliot was able to memorialize this with his video footage. At this point, my options were quite limited. I couldn't ski and Elliot couldn't carry me. We considered using our skis to make a sled, but had to climb up a significant hill, so didn't think that was likely to be effective. I was already cold, and I knew it would take at least several more hours for Elliot to ski out, contact the search and rescue team, and for them to return. I decided my only reasonable option was to tighten my ski boot, adding some stability to my ankle, and fortify myself for a slow, very painful hike/ski out of the backcountry. I used my ski poles and my good leg to carry me up and across the slopes, while hopelessly trying to let my injured one gently dangle. This journey back to our car took a couple of hours and was accompanied by a lifetime's worth of cursing. As an interesting side note, I had recently read a study by Stevens, Atkins, and Kingston in which they evaluated swearing as a response to pain. Neuro Report, August 5, 2009, Volume 20, Issue 12, 1056-60. In the study, two sets of data were collected based on how long volunteers were able to keep their arms submersed in ice water, a known pain stimulator, while either shouting a commonplace word to describe a table or shouting the profanity of their choice. The authors found that volunteers had a significantly greater pain tolerance when using their profanity of choice. As I hiked the distance to our car, I performed my own personal experiment. I tried yelling words like snow and tree, or yelling different profanities. In the end, I agreed wholeheartedly with the results of Stephen's study. I had surgery that evening to repair my ankle and remained in the hospital overnight. A Rwandan priest named Father Ubald just happened to be visiting a friend in Jackson Hole at that time, and she brought him to the hospital to pray with me. To understand who Father Ubald is and what he represents, you must understand a little about his history. The origins of the 1994 Rwandan genocide are complex, and the ethnic divisions in Rwanda between the Hutus and Tutsis are long-standing. Tribal polarization exploded after the assassination of President Juvenal Habyarimana, who was a Hutu, and in a period of 100 days, more than 800,000 people were systematically and violently murdered. In the midst of this killing, Father Ubald, a Catholic priest whose Tutsi father had been murdered in the 1962 overthrow of the Rwandan government and who had been himself threatened by fellow seminarians in the 1980s, was forced to flee first to his bishop's residence and then to the Congo in return for a promise by the Hutus not to harm the people of his parish. As soon as he left, the Hutu members of his large parish betrayed this promise and brutally hacked to death approximately 45,000 Tutsi members of his parish. More than 80 members of his immediate and extended family, including his mother, were exterminated within the first 2 weeks of the massacre. Before fleeing, Father Ubald promised his bishop that he would return to bring healing to his people. The massacre finally ended when the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, regained power, but grief-stricken survivors were left bewildered by the intensity of the evil that had been unleashed in their country. Survivors of all ethnic groups experienced profound guilt, guilt for killing, guilt for surviving, guilt for not doing enough to prevent or mitigate the conflicts. Many sought revenge, but as has been said, there is no revenge so complete as forgiveness. Father Ubald spent many months in prayer, and his tears filled a river before he made his way to Lourdes, France. It was there, as he meditated on the Stations of the Cross, that he heard God tell him to release his sorrows and pick up his cross. God filled his heart with a forgiveness that can only come from God. Subsequently, he met with and forgave the mayor of his town, who was the man who ordered the murder of Father Ubald's own mother. Father Ubald took responsibility for that man's children, treating them as his own, and even paying for their schooling. Father Ubald is a man who radiates the purity of God's grace and preaches on forgiveness and reconciliation. He also holds healing masses, using his gifts to heal and renew others. He performs healing masses in Rwanda, Europe, and the United States. He is building a center in Rwanda called the Secret of Peace, which will minister to the people of Rwanda and the surrounding areas of the Congo and Burundi, countries that have seen so much war, poverty, and trauma. He works tirelessly toward the goal of forgiveness, reconciliation, and peace for the people of Rwanda and throughout the world. It was because of his background and experience in healing that my friend, Katsi, brought him to my hospital room to pray over my ankle. When they arrived, I was so ill from the anesthetics and the pain medications that they quickly left. The following day, Father Ubald insisted that I visit him at Katsi's house once I was feeling better. I arranged a visit a few days later, and I brought Bill with me. We chatted briefly, but then Father Ubald immediately focused on Bill. Together, they prayed for more than an hour. I wanted to cry at the beauty of this, as I have never seen Bill be outwardly spiritual, and this was an answer to many years of my prayers. The following week, Father Ubald had dinner in our home, and the conversation turned to the topic of loss. Knowing his history of loss and grief makes listening to his thoughts quite compelling and powerful, so we were riveted as he described his own and his country's experiences with loss and the ongoing process of grief and forgiveness. He believes that the complex emotions related to loss almost always include some sort of anger or rage, guilt or shame that requires forgiveness before true healing, acceptance, and reconciliation can occur. Father Ubald also noted that forgiveness does not need to be two-sided. It comes from within a person and does not require the involvement, acknowledgement, or acceptance of the other. As we discussed the many facets of forgiveness, I began to recognize that although I really did believe Willie's death was part of God's larger plan, I felt anger and perhaps rage in the core of my sadness. I was angry that Eric had been so careless in his driving that he killed my beautiful son. I was angry that he never contacted us afterward to express remorse or sorrow, and angry that, according to some reports I'd heard, he was continuing to be what I termed a dead-ender, someone without much going on in his life, few goals, and no passion to make a difference in the world or even in himself. I was angry that he stole my son's life, yet seemed not to be making the most of his own opportunity for a full life. I knew I needed to forgive him and pray for his future. I was also angry with myself and felt a sense of shame and guilt. The week before Willie's death, I had been visiting schools in Vermont with my daughter, and although I could have made it work, I decided not to spend the extra time and money to combine this trip with a trip to Maine to visit my sons at the ski training facility. This was one of my very few regrets with regard to Willie's life and death, and it haunted me a little bit. I knew I needed to forgive myself. I was also haunted by a feeling that I had failed in my responsibility to God. I knew that one of the reasons for my being sent back to Earth after my boating accident was to help support my family, and more specifically, help my husband deal with the death of our son. I was also meant to help them discover their relationship with God. I had tried my best, but in February 2010, I didn't think any of them were closer to God, and Bill was still filled with a pervasive sense of despair. I felt empty and defeated. I was incapable of helping him, my kids, or myself. As I listened to Father Ubald speak, I contemplated his loving and joyful manner. It then suddenly occurred to me that my sense of failure was self-inflicted and egocentric. I had stopped looking to God for help, believing that I was expected to do it all on my own, believing that I could do it all on my own. In the process, I had let doubts, fear, and guilt silently creep in and take over my thoughts. I was still in the valley of the shadow of death, and the door of my heart was propped wide open. Right then and there, I asked God for help and immediately felt forgiven and free, knowing that God was in control. I prayed for guidance, requesting that God would help our family move forward in the process of grieving, and prayed that Bill would begin to see a glimmer of hope for the future. Once again, I would say that God answered my prayers, though definitely not in the way I had imagined. In our conversation on loss and forgiveness, Father Ubald identified Bill's sense of despair, and I think my sense of failure. He noted that while sadness reflects love, despair reflects the destruction of the soul that often accompanies grief. He then got up from the table, filled a bowl with water, blessed the water, and proceeded to move throughout our home, sprinkling this holy water on everything he saw. Actually, pouring handfuls of water would be a more accurate description. He spread holy water in every area of every room, in every closet, and on every object and every surface, on everything everywhere. As he did so, he commanded that the evil of despair leave our home and leave our family. I have never been a Catholic, so I am not sure what to think about holy water, but I do know one thing. Our lives changed after Father Ubald's visit. We still felt the sadness of loss, but the sense of fear and despair that had been slowly destroying our lives departed that evening. Is it just coincidental that I broke my ankle at the time Father Ubald was visiting, or that I was too ill to speak with him in the hospital, thereby providing the opportunity for Father Ubald to bring healing to me, to Bill, and to our family? Perhaps it is. But I think it is more likely another example of God's perfectly and choreographed sequence of events. Chapter 33. Logical Conclusions. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. 1 Corinthians 13, New International Version. As I consider the story of my life, I recognize that each of my experiences has prepared me for the next one. There is a divine sequence and order to my life, and this sequence prepared me for my greatest challenge to date: the death of my son. Since his death, I continue to cling to my daily creed, the one taped to the fridge, because it reflects the convictions and logical conclusions I already know to be true based on my past experiences. 1. I believe God's promises are true. God promises not to leave us nor forsake us. God promises to open the door when we knock and to always welcome us back into his love, no matter how far we have strayed. In my life, he fulfilled these promises when he brought George into my life, when he was with me in the tumbling car, when he showed me and my scuba instructor the way out of the Florida cave, and when I drowned on a South American river. He loved me even when I was an angry adolescent and when I let him slip into the background of my life. I could be confident that God had a plan for Willie and for us. 2. I believe heaven is real. My patient Jennifer saw the angels. My patient who died after spinal surgery saw angels and described both the angels and heaven to his wife. I experienced heaven firsthand after my kayaking accident. The heaven I witnessed was so pure, love-filled, and magnificent that I did not want to return to earth. When my life still hung in the balance, I was also reassured that my husband and children would be okay even if I died. I have no doubt that Willie was hesitant to leave his family behind and sorry for what we would bear, but I also have no doubt that he was similarly reassured before jubilantly returning to God. 3. I believe nothing can separate me from God's love. God's love was present with me when I was spinning out of control, when the truck was stuck in the mud in the middle of the Mexican mountains, as well as during the various times when I was anxious about my personal life or work situations. He held me and loved me when I was pinned in a waterfall and dying. He kept me from feeling pain or worry. The experience of his presence, love, and compassion reassures me that Willie suffered no pain at the end of his life. His spirit probably left his body long before it was broken, and I feel confident that he was greeted by a host of overjoyed and excited witnesses. 4. I believe God has work for me to do. While in the hospital after my boating accident, the angels talked about the work we all do on earth, and they discussed some specifics about the work I still needed to do. Clearly, Willie completed his job on earth. He lived passionately. He loved deeply. He achieved success, and he inspired others to become better people. He accomplished a great deal in his 19 years and made this world a better place for all. He got the job done. 5. I believe God will see me through and carry me when I cannot walk. There are many cycles in a person's life, and everyone experiences hurt, worry, disappointment, grief, and other difficulties. It has been said that one cannot truly appreciate joy without also experiencing sorrow. I had survived many sorrows before Willie's death, some minor and some major. God was with me for each one, carrying me forward until I was able to walk on my own and nurture the very small seed of hope for the future that he buries within each of us. This history allows me the certainty of knowing that no matter how devastated and doubtful of the future I may feel, God will always be there to walk with me and carry me into a joyful future. Each event, whether joyous or sorrowful, has given me greater awareness of God's role in my life and has led me to a deeper faith in God's unfailing love. I still don't know what the future holds for me. I do not doubt God's promises, and I am grateful for the privilege of having had Willie in our lives. He was a great teacher and role model, a great son and friend. Willie believed that change begins with the individual, and passionately embraced Mahatma Gandhi's idea, we must be the change we wish to see in the world. In Willie's seemingly accelerated life on earth, he accomplished a great deal and inspired others to do the same. He showed others a better way of living. He was certainly the change he wished to see in the world. He knew who he was and what he stood for. He reached for his dreams. He was kind and always thought about others before himself. He expected each of us to look in the mirror every evening and ask what we, not someone else, have done today to help someone else or make this world a better place for all. I do not believe that a loss of the magnitude I've experienced in losing Willie is something a person gets beyond, works through, or any of those other well-meaning but impossible-to-achieve platitudes. Grieving a loss is a matter of learning to incorporate the pain into a new life and a new reality. As Martha Hickman wrote in her book, Healing After Loss, HarperCollins, 2009, there is no way out, only forward. Many have said that my experience is remarkable. Perhaps it is. What I find more remarkable, however, is how readily many people in our society believe outlandish and unsubstantiated urban myths and conspiracies, Pop Rocks and Coke, JFK assassination, AIDS is man-made, etc., yet disregard thousands of personal and consistent testimonies of miracles and near-death experiences from people throughout all cultures and religions. I have spent more than 10 years reflecting on my experiences and wondering what I am meant to do with them. In this process, I have continued to be what I have always been, a wife and mother, a spine surgeon, a scientist, a realist, and a cynic. Yet I am profoundly changed. I know that above all else, I am a child of God. I know that God loves and values each person on earth. I know that we are each only small threads in God's glorious tapestry. But I also know that our choices and our actions are important and really do make a difference. This knowledge has changed the way I interact with my medical patients. I recognize how significantly a patient's emotional and spiritual health impacts their recovery, and I am able to use my own experiences to give them hope, even in the midst of substantial disability or injury. I often pray for my patients, and occasionally with them. I now see my professional role as more of a healer rather than of someone who just fixes their mechanical problem. I do not know why God chose to intervene in my life. I have led a very ordinary life. I was raised with religion but never truly claimed God's promises for myself until I was in high school. I spent little time thinking about my spiritual life when I was an undergraduate student, even though I believe God intervened in my life when I was scuba diving in the Florida Springs. I could say the same for my time in medical school and residency. Like many people, I was consumed by the details and obligations of daily life and by the familiar challenge of balancing the needs of work, marriage, and children. Despite being personally touched by God's presence in my life, my spirituality did not begin to blossom until I thought about what I wanted for my children. Since I feel quite ordinary in so many ways, I continue to ask the ordinary question, why me? Why did God choose to give me these extraordinary experiences instead of showing himself to my cousin who died in the talons of drug addiction, or to any of the millions of other believers on earth who have cried out for his help? I am analytical, scientific, and skeptical by nature and by training. I'm not sure I would believe all of the events of my life story to be true if I had not personally lived each day of them. How can all that I have described happen in one person's life? And why is it so hard to stop doubting and just believe? I do not know all of the answers to these questions, but I do know that millions of people are in dire need of knowing God, receiving His love, experiencing His presence, and accepting the truth of His promises. People ask why so many miracles occurred in ancient days, but not in our present time. I contend that there are just as many miracles occurring today in the lives of ordinary people. But I also assert that most of us don't look for miracles, don't recognize them for what they really are, and don't really believe them to be of divine origin, even if their miraculous nature is noticed. My life's experiences would argue against the concepts of coincidence and luck. It would support the belief that there is only the guiding presence and plan of God, who uses His assortment of angels and messengers to lead us and communicate with us. King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes that people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end, and I would heartily agree. We live our lives in forward motion, but only understand them when looking backward. I therefore challenge you to keep a 6 to 12 month journal of coincidence. In that journal, write down the details of every coincidence you experience. In one column, write the details of each major event in your life. What are/were the circumstances surrounding your acceptance into college, meeting your significant other, finding your job, choosing where you live, and so on. Note every time the arrangements easily fall into place. Similarly, every time you struggle with a situation, write down the eventual outcome. Write down the bad things that happen to you or others, and in an adjacent column, list what happens as a direct or indirect result of these bad things. I believe that when you look back through your journal at the end of your exercise, you will clearly see how many of people, events, decisions, and outcomes are interconnected. I think you will see a pattern of linkage that cannot be attributed to statistical chance. You will see evidence of God's work in your life, giving assurance that God has a plan for your life. You will begin to recognize coincidental events for the miracles they really are, and you will know that God is with you, even in times of sorrow, loneliness, or other misfortune. To paraphrase what Chad Long once said, let's not let life muddle what happens. We are all part of a miracle. It is written in Hebrews 11, verse 1, New International Version. Faith is being sure of what we hoped for and certain of what we do not see. Martin Luther King Jr. translated this into the world of action when he stated, "Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase." It is this faith that sets us free. It allows us to fully embrace life, dissolves fear, and replaces worry with hope. Faith allows us to confidently walk with God into a future filled with joy, one that can become an extraordinary and amazing adventure. God created us, knows us, loves us, and guides us. With love and grace, He commands us to rejoice in this knowledge always, live a life of prayer, giving glory to God and continually listening for His guidance. Live a life of gratitude, giving thanks in all circumstances. Giving back. You can give without loving, but you cannot love without giving. Amy Carmichael. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of this book will be given to charitable organizations that strive to share God's grace and love in our country and the world. Encourage individuals to make each day and each choice matter and to work to make the world a better place for all. Promote responsible stewardship of the world that has been given to us. Help bring people into a loving relationship with God. For further information, please visit www.drmaryneal.com. On this website, you will find information about the specific nonprofit organizations to which donations are made. You will also find a means by which you can suggest other nonprofit organizations that should be considered. Q&A with Dr. Neal. Since the publication of my book, I have answered many questions about the details of my experiences. Some of the most frequently asked questions are addressed as follows. Where is Jesus in this story? I believe Jesus was holding me, comforting me, and reassuring me when I was drowning. I also believe that it was with Jesus I was conversing when sitting in the beautiful field during my out-of-body experiences. I did not clearly state this when I wrote the first edition of my book because I still felt uncomfortable with this claim. I am an ordinary person, and it seemed so presumptuous and arrogant to think that Jesus would take the time to be with me. Do you belong to a church? I regularly attend church services and have served on the board of elders, but I believe that loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength is of the greatest importance. I live in a beautiful and mountainous area, and many people claim the mountains as their church and believe they can worship God there instead of within a building. That can certainly be true, but the question, as is often posed by my pastor, is not can a person worship God while in the mountains, but will that person worship God while in the mountains? Regardless of the harm that some individuals have done in the name of God or while hiding behind the doors of the church, I believe the institution is greater than the individuals within it. Churches provide a place of gathering for people who share common beliefs, support, and encouragement for each other in faith, a place to find insight into and teaching about God's Word, and they provide a time and place where people can leave the world behind and focus only on their spiritual relationship with God. Just as God can meet us wherever we are, the variety of denominations allows for accommodation of people in all stages of spiritual growth. Are you just doing this for the money? I, too, am skeptical of the motivation of many people, but God has given me these experiences for a purpose, and I am trying to be obedient to what He has asked of me. Proceeds from the sale of this book help support several nonprofit organizations. The current list of charities supported can be found on the Giving Back page of my website. Why did it take so long to write your book? I believe that the fact that I really, really did not want to return to Earth is an important part of my story. At the time of my kayaking accident, my four children were quite young, and other than telling my close friends and church about it, I didn't speak much about my experiences because I never wanted my children to think that they weren't enough of a reason for me to come back. I was a surgeon, wife, and mother of four, which did not allow much time for writing, and frankly, I didn't want to do it. I was not a writer and was a very private person. Ultimately, God's timing is always perfect. I finished writing the first complete draft hours before my son's death. Why should I believe you? Aren't you just trying to convince people of your way of believing? The job I was given was to share my experiences as accurately and precisely as I can. This is all I am trying to do. What did the people look like who were with you in heaven? The people/beings were brilliant. They had physical form, but seemed to be wearing flowing robes such that I did not see distinct arms or legs. I did see their heads, but their brilliance seemed to blur the edges such that their features were indistinct. They seemed neither young nor old, just timeless. When I had my out-of-body experiences while in intensive care, I saw children playing at the far end of the field in which I was sitting. What did Jesus look like? I believe Jesus was holding me when I was still underwater. At that point, I heard him speaking to me, but did not see him. I believe it was Jesus with whom I was conversing in the sun-kissed field during my later out-of-body experiences. He was sitting on a rock while I was sitting on the ground, and like the people who led me down the path to heaven, he was wearing some sort of flowing robe and exploded with beauty and brilliance. His hair was long. His features were indistinct. I don't know how to describe this, but my greatest impression of his appearance was that of love. Yes, I realize we don't typically see love, but as I said, I don't know how to describe this phenomenon of seeing something we would normally feel. He conveyed the impression of complete love, compassion, kindness, and infinite patience. Did you see pets? I did not see animals, but I experienced only a couple of places and have no idea about the things and places I did not experience. What were your injuries, and why didn't you arrange for a medical evacuation? I am surprised that readers have wanted to know the details of my injuries, but here they are. In one leg, I suffered a tibial plateau fracture, a meniscal tear, and tears of the posterior cruciate ligament, the posterior capsule, and the collateral ligaments of my knee. In the other leg, I suffered a proximal tibia and fibula fracture, and tears of the posterior capsule and collateral ligaments, and a stretch of the posterior cruciate ligament. Basically, my knees bent entirely backward upon themselves in order for my body to exit the kayak. By the time I arrived in the emergency room, I also had developed pneumonia and severe respiratory distress syndrome, basically a shock reaction of the lungs to trauma, which is a condition that dramatically decreases the ability of the lungs to transfer oxygen to the bloodstream. Supplemental oxygen and supportive care are important, but other than allowing time for the lungs to heal, there is no particularly effective treatment for this condition, and it often leads to death. I initially had oxygen saturation levels in the 40s. Normal levels should be 80 to 100, increasing to the 60s with supplemental oxygen. Generally, these levels are not sustainable without expecting severe organ damage. I developed deep venous thrombosis in my legs, which required anticoagulation, and I underwent multiple surgeries and extensive rehabilitation. I did not suffer brain injury, and eventually my legs healed as well as could be expected. I certainly live with the long-term consequences of my physical injuries, but I have been able to return to many physical recreational activities. We should have called for a medical evacuation. Although it turned out okay for me, it was foolish and ill-conceived and not something I would ever recommend. I had decided to fly home to be with my children, and I rationalized that because I was a doctor, my legs had been splinted, and I would be traveling with another physician, my husband, all would be fine. However, I was certainly in a state of shock and felt little connection to the cares of this world. My husband was in a state of shock, too. Someone could have told us we were not thinking clearly, but we were the only physicians, and I think everyone deferred to our judgment, or lack thereof. Frankly, I am embarrassed by this part of my story. What was your faith like before your kayaking accident, and how did your spiritual life change afterward? Before my near-death experience, I was a Christian and believed that the Bible was the absolute and historically accurate Word of God. I was not, however, what anyone would call deeply spiritual or deeply religious, and had no preconceived notions about life after death. My experience changed me profoundly in both spiritual and religious ways. I now know the promises of God to be true, that there is a life after death and our spiritual life is eternal. While recognizing the limitations of organized religion, I fully participate in and support it. How has your understanding of God changed? The absolute knowledge that God is real, that He has a plan for each of us, and that there really is life after death changes the way I experience each day. I do not fear death, and that also changes the way I experience the death of others, even my own son. I know that every day really does matter, and that I need to be about God's business every day. I also know that God loves all people deeply and unconditionally, even those people whom I may not like or agree with. It motivates me to try to see the beauty in them that God sees. How can these experiences be applied to others or used to face challenges? I have given many details of my life, not so that anyone should try to replicate them, but to show others that if you can transform your faith into trust, you can face any challenge with a grateful and joyful heart. What I mean is this. A small child has hope. Hope that God will do what He says He will do. When we hear about and see God working in the lives of others, that hope transforms into a faith that God will really do what He says He will do. Not everyone has a profound spiritual experience, such as a near-death experience. But taking the time to really look at the patterns of your everyday life and noting how events seem to unfold in a manner that is unlikely a result of chance, allow any person of faith to begin to see God working in his own life. I think it is only when a person truly sees God working in his own life that this faith can be transformed into a complete trust that God's promises are true. Complete trust that God has a beautiful plan, and that it is one with a hope and a future allows me and each of us to face challenges with confidence and courage, even when the plan and its beauty seem hidden. This is Rebecca Lohman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of To Heaven and Back, a doctor's extraordinary account of her death, heaven, angels, and life again, a true story by Mary C. Neal, M.D. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2011-2012 by Mary C. Neal. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.